Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is John Irving, the author most recently of Trying to Save Piggy Sneed, a miscellany in the true sense of the word. It's composed of memoirs, fiction, and critical homages to favorite writers, or at least two favorite writers, Dickens and Gunter Grass. It's been brought to us in paperback by Ballantine. Need I tell you that he is the author as well of A Son of the Circus, A Prayer for Owen Meany, The Cider House Rules, The Hotel New Hampshire, The World According to Garp, The 158-Pound Marriage, and A Miracle That Happened in My Life When I Was in College, a book called The Water Method Man, which was sent to me by the publisher and which I read in marvel. I got to know John Irving two books before everyone else did, and the first book was Setting Free the Bears. Now, in the collection Trying to Save Piggy Sneed, you say something thrilling. You say that you have no taste for what non-writers call good and bad taste. And that's the thrilling salvation of all of these books, that they begin at the place where distinctions like that become meaningless. Can you speak about that?
Well, it seems to me that so-called good taste, when it's applied to literature, is usually the jurisdiction of school boards or parent groups who are opposed to books being taught to their children, which are probably the only books their children really should or must read. It has to me such a sensorial force, the idea of good taste being upheld for any reason. It's always reminded me as a kind of application of a dress code to literature, and it just doesn't apply. Good literature is always, it seems to me, in one kind of bad taste or another. It is always against the grain of whatever the conventional wisdom or the wisdom of the day is. It's no surprise to me why most of the interesting books of our time and of previous times are constantly being attacked by library boards and school boards, and books are being expected to uphold a kind of community standard which is, in general, a blandness to the extreme.
Well, I want to tell a story because, you know, I became aware that there was something special that happens in a John Irving book when I lent one to my mother. I must tell you that when she read the most recent, The Son of the Circus, she called me up midway and asked me, what is a dildo and had John Irving invented them? And I said, no, he hasn't invented them. She said, oh, it sounds like a John Irving name for something. But the great quality has been that the books have a liberating quality for people who would never think of reading something that they knew to be titillating. They're delighted by the secrecy almost, the deliciousness, the fact that they are given these extravagant nuggets in the middle of such big, thick, respectable-looking books.
Well, it's an embarrassment to me that my books are so respectable-looking or have become so respectable-looking. I sort of liked it in a way better when my reputation as a writer was that of a rather scruffy and unkempt person who was always suspected of a kind of coarseness and a vulgarity that broke all boundaries of civilized behavior. It happens to me that when I go and give a reading, I gave a reading last fall at Yale, and a very nice young man came up to me in the audience and said that he'd never read a word of of mine before, but he'd come to the reading with a very beaten-up copy of what he called his father's favorite book. And I can remember when people my age were approaching me and saying with some suspicion that I was being read by their children, and you could tell by the way they said it that they hadn't read a word of me. Mm. Well, now it's come full circle, and kids come up to me and say that I'm their parents' favorite writer. I don't know how I feel about that.
Well, I wanted to pursue this talk on terms called by the initial essay in the book and also by its final essay. It's a wonderful description. It's an imagination of telling Günter Grass what it was like to meet Thomas Mann's daughter on a plane and to wonder, in fact, what book one could send this august a figure as Thomas Mann's daughter. Well, you know, the water method man has information about the urinary tract, not everyone's cup of tea, and Owen Meany has religion, etc. And so there is this sense that on all levels, the appropriateness of a book comes into play, and it's in a way the subject of the initial essay. There's a piggy sneed in a town. He's ridiculed, half-retarded by the local kids. And the author comes to the decision that the writer's job is not only to save Piggy Sneed, but to build a fire large and interesting enough to attract attention to his rescue. And it's the building of the fire that I want to talk about, because it seems to me that getting the characters in trouble is one of the best things you do.
Well, I think that there's a stage before you get the character in trouble, which is all important, and that is you have to involve the reader emotionally and psychologically in the well-being of the character. And that only happens when you can make the reader anxious for a character, when you can make the reader love a character or sympathize with a character. And once you establish the sympathy or the concern, so that the character in the book becomes almost like a stray family member for the reader. The reader feels some sort of personal and emotional stake in what happens to the character. Then you begin to hurt the character in unmentionable ways. but you can't begin to sort of do the character harm or put the character at risk until you've established that affection that the reader must feel for the character, because if the reader doesn't feel that, the reader doesn't care what risk the character is in. The reader doesn't care what happens to the character. You've got to make the reader care about, be interested in, sort of long to know the outcome of this character's life before you begin to visit upon that character all kinds of jeopardy and pain. I don't know. I also, when I say pain, I laugh a little, but it's just because it's a very manipulative business telling a story. I mean, you do or you must make the reader committed to finding out what's going to happen.
Well, in this century, at least, it seems, although I'm lying here because it's true of Rabelais and it's true of Cervantes and it's true of literature at every stage of the game, Ben Jonson, but in your work there seems to be a premium placed on interesting ways, surprising ways, new ways, unseen ways to inflict pain. And I'm not wondering why exactly. I'm wondering rather whether the circus begins to require more and more high-wire acts. Does there come a point where that kind of invention seems de rigueur and therefore unpalatable?
Well, I don't know if that kind of adventure in a novel is ever going to lose its interest for readers. I know that there is a danger for any writer who's written more than one book, which is that that sense of topping yourself that every writer from time to time must feel. I'm more than three quarters of the way through my ninth novel, which, although it's called A Widow for 1 Year, on page 679, the poor woman hasn't even been married yet. So that I begin to worry that I'm pushing the envelope. I begin to worry sometimes that I am stretching my trust in the reader's stamina. But I just have to believe that my readers like that they like the demands that I put on them. One concession I think I've made to that very thing you're talking about is this is the first novel I've written in 15 years, which is, again, a chronological narrative. That is, it begins with a childhood and goes in a linear direction through the story. I've been purposely avoiding that for the last three novels, beginning with The Cider House Rules, including A Prayer for Owen Meany and A Son of the Circus. I've very deliberately begun the story not at the beginning, so that there is as much flashback as there is going forward. And in the case of A Son of the Circus, more flashback than there is going forward. I mean, the story begins three-quarters of the way through the story. I've liked that kind of texture, that kind of complexity. But I've done it now for three books, and I feel it's time for a change. For me, no, I'm not thinking so much of my readers as just for me, I wanted to go back to that simpler linear narrative, which is the narrative, or was the narrative, of The World According to Garp and The Hotel New Hampshire. Maybe I'm saying nothing more than that I'm 54 and I'm tired of writing novels that are harder to write than a straightforward linear narrative, but I seem to have gone back to that kind of a narrative in this ninth novel.
I would say, and by the way, my guest is John Irving, the author most recently of Trying to Save Piggy Sneed, published in paperback by Ballantine. I would say, in fact, that there are very few writers who have more solicitude for the reader and for keeping the reader engrossed. In fact, the book Trying to Save Piggy Sneed gives this reader the pleasure of rereading the terrific story at the heart of Garp, the pension girl parser. And as I was rereading that story, I'm taken yet again by how delicious the seduction is. These are stories that you can't not want to read. Having read a paragraph, the next paragraph, they have the secrets of pistachio nuts. One paragraph opens the next. And what thrilled me when I was rereading it was that it seemed in that story to be a figure for what you say about memoir in general, that what is imagined is much richer than what is remembered.
It's a pleasure for me to be able to let people read that story as it was written, and not, I feel, as I had to sacrifice it in the context of the novel. It was my editor's judgment that the most unlikely thing about The World According to Garp was that a 19-year-old wrote the Pension Grosspatzer. In fact, I was 36 when I wrote it. And he said that the least I could do to make it more plausible that the 19-year-old Garp had written this story was to make the writing of the story itself more of a struggle for Garp, and to interrupt it with more events in Garp's life to suggest that Garp got stuck in the middle of it and couldn't finish it or put it down, which honestly has never happened to me. But I believe that the editor was right. I still believe that he was right, that in the case of a novel, any part of it must really serve the whole, and the novel is the primary objective, and so I sacrifice the story. I feel a little bit in order to make the novel more credible, and I was very happy to be able to resurrect it in whole cloth in this collection, because I think most readers who ever read it previously read it in the context of the novel, in which case they read it in a very sort of interrupted and sort of chopped up form. Its principal theme, that of humanity sort of lining up for classification and reclassification, to be identified and to be re-identified. The sense of people living within a hierarchy and always struggling to achieve something better than a C rating was something that I remember as a young American. I felt very keenly the first time I went to Europe. It seemed that I was, for the first time, aware of people who are struggling, just to maintain a status quo and a sense of class and position in society that was far more fixed and far more rigid and sort of unshatterable than our own kind of random success stories and random failures, which fit more boisterously the American mode of anybody can get to be president, we're always saying, when of course we understand that the downside of that is that anyone can be homeless and summarily ignored.
The editor in that case was the brilliant Henry Robbins, and more than one writer owes his entire career to the lamented Henry Robbins, Joan Didion, and many others. What, after you had done GARP, had you reached a point where you no longer needed the interventions of an editor? Because one hears that there aren't as many ever as intuitive as a man like Henry Robbins had been.
Well, I think you have to distinguish in Henry's case between his abilities as an editor, as a line editor, which were considerable, and his power and influence as a publisher. There have been other great editors, fortunately for me, in my life. I'm with one right now. Harvey Ginsberg is officially retired from Morrow, but even with my last novel, which Random House published, Harvey was hired as the editor. I insisted on it, and I will insist on having Harvey edit me as long as Harvey is willing to be semi-retired. he's a great line editor, but Harvey never wanted, nor did Joe Fox, my former editor at Random House, ever want to be a powerful publisher in the sense that Henry Robbins was. They loved books, Joe and Harvey. They wanted to take those manuscripts home and work on them and help you make those manuscripts better. Henry was that way too, but Henry wanted his own imprint, which he had at Dutton, and Henry could sort of make things happen for a heretofore unknown writer. I was lucky to go to Henry with my fourth book. It was GARP was a publishing coup for him, and I'll forever be the beneficiary of leaving a big house at the time, Random House, where I was a medium-sized fish in a huge pond, and going to Dutton, where Henry Robbins got the entire sales force and the entire company behind me, which probably couldn't have happened at the time for a writer of my unknown qualities at a house the size of Random House.
And I remember when I read The Water Method Man, I it was the only book review I think I ever wrote, I think in college. I loved it. And I couldn't believe that people hadn't found that book. I couldn't believe that people weren't reading it. It seemed a necessary book, especially at that moment. That was the 60s. There were huge amounts of gender confusion in the air. And this is the story of a man who realizes that if he can get his emotional story straight, he can also get his sexual story straight. That the two are finally one. May I ask you, and to my knowledge, you've never answered these types of questions, and you don't have to now, but one of the reasons why I think that these books are important beyond their amusement value and their wonderful structures and their surprises is that they engage subjects that are of great importance. People are concerned about things, and one of the things they're concerned about is gender confusion. And one of the areas in which these novels have really made their mark is that, almost like a dream, like ghosts, these figures of transgenders stalk these novels, sometimes without any ability to say, in fact, why they're there. The subject matter grows more profound. It is looked at in A Son of the Circus as a whole social order with its own customs and network and way of living and way of looking at others. And I wanted to ask you what you can say about that subject.
Well, I think that what you call gender confusion is simply one aspect of what I would call gender decisions. And it seems to me that there is no greater decision in most of our lives, provided we're not at war or in some violent political crisis. Provided we're not struggling over the death or near death of some loved one, or something caused by the mayhem of violence, the chaos of random violence, those issues aside, the question that concerns people for an important part, if not a long enduring part of their lives, is who do we sleep with and why? For how long does it last? What tempts us sexually and morally, as opposed or alongside how we exist sexually, how we sort of go through the motions sexually and morally? So that our sexual lives has always been, if there can be one subject that my eight novels, now almost nine, could collectively be about, I would say that sexual decisions, rather than sort of gender confusion, I would say that sexual decisions are kind of street maps in all of the books. It's no coincidence, for example, that Garp's mother, Jenny Fields, Dr. Larch in The Cider House Rules, Johnny Wheelwright in A Prayer for Old Meanie, are all by choice sexually abstemious, as if the only way one can sort of carry the mantle of the almost sainthood they aspire to. Mm-hmm. Is to simply never make that decision. Mm-hmm. I think that some years ago, when Andy Warhol was still alive and said, among many of the oversimplifications that he was given to, but in many cases brilliant oversimplifications nonetheless, he remarked that more and more people were becoming sexually abstemious, and that
sex is work, he said.
Yeah, that at some point in time, it seemed to me that we might live in a place where almost no one would willingly choose to have sex. Well, that's, I think that that's a, if not a reasonable, in my view, that is an understandable. It's an understandable decision.
It's so interesting to me, because to go full circle, when novels become popular and they're good novels, I have to begin to ask myself why, and then in this particular case, why does my mother love these books? It's not a silly question. It's a real question. They ask interesting questions. Who was the father and who was the mother? Not just biologically, but sexually. Can the father be a mother? And can the mother in her career be a father? And in every questioning of parenthood and childhood, it's as if people's sexual roles, their social roles, their sense of their own possibilities, their control over their bodies are examined in these novels, which may, in its odd way, be the end of the century question.
Yes. I think it was it's a Graham Greene line that goes something along the every Graham Greene lover is going to phone in and tell me what a mess I've made of this quotation, but it goes something along the lines of even a hunchback or a cripple can trigger love. What he's saying is we don't know where that spark is coming from. You know, it's right up there with one of those other Graham Greene-isms that there's a moment in childhood when the door opens and lets the future in. I would say, well, let's a future in anyway. But there is, you know, if one had to say what story always gets my attention, it is the moment in any story when someone is sexually attracted to someone else. Bang. That's all. I mean, that's if you want to know how to begin a story or how to make a story which seems stagnant move ahead, begin with that. And I'm not saying that every story must be a love story or that love stories are superior to other kinds of stories. I'm not talking about love. I'm talking about, the appalling distraction of sexual attraction.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to John Irving. The occasion is the paperback version from Ballantine of Trying to Save Piggy Sneed. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jennifer Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse Club Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.